Welcome to Top Cut Savvy with John Early and Josiah Beers.
Hey guys, John Early, got another episode of Top Cut Savvy for you here. I'm with my usual co-host,
Josiah Beers. How's everybody doing?
So here's our plan for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to talk about staple cards. And what I mean by that is these are cards that you want to play no matter what deck you're playing. So we're going to hone in on Dominance. Dominance are some of the most powerful cards in the game, and you are limited to 7 of them typically. It's the number of lost souls that you have in your deck, which determines deck size and things like that. So the typical deck is going to play somewhere between 50 and 56 cards, 50 being the minimum, 56 being the most cards you can play without increasing the lost soul count in your deck. So typical deck plays 7 lost souls and then is allowed to play 7 dominance. Josiah, how about you talk a little bit about what your vision of staple dominance is?
Sure. So like John was talking about having cards that go in every single deck. And so for me, on dominance, that tends to really lean towards 4 and maybe 5. And then I fluctuate a little bit on 6 and 7, usually varies depending on the deck that I'm playing. So obviously our staples for dominance are going to be Son of God. It's inherently the most powerful card in the game. It doesn't require a turn. It doesn't require you to create any game state other than having your opponent draw a lost soul for you to be able to rescue. And you just get a point. So when you need to get to 5 lost souls to win the game, Son of God gives you one of those. It's obviously 20% of your win condition is met with a single card. It's the best card in the game. The second card then is the Second Coming, which I guess actually, now that I say it, some people might argue that the Second Coming is better than the Son of God. But my contention has always been Son of God is better than Second Coming because the Second Coming can only duplicate the other dominance. Therefore, since it doesn't inherently do anything on its own, you're required to have another card, one, for it to work, and two, it can only copy the ability of another card. So that card inherently that plays and gives the Second Coming an ability to copy is inherently better, in my opinion. So I rank Son of God above the Second Coming. It's debatable. Some people get on the other side of that conversation. But then the Second Coming, for me, Angel of the Lord is a constant. I always play that card. Played right in the right situation, I don't see it getting a lost soul in less than, I don't know, John, what would you say, 95% of games? Like,
I don't know if I go that high. I'd honestly go 75.
Okay.
I feel like 75% of the time, it works 100% of the time. You know, something like that.
Sure.
I think 95% of the time, it should put you in position to rescue a soul. I will say that in the modern redemption era, there are more answers than ever to Angel of the Lord. Things sure. Like Shoal, Gates of Hell, the new Unknown Nation is a solid card. Honestly, the old Unknown Nation was a solid card, just nobody played it because there were so many search counters. The new Unknown Nation being able to go to reserve instead of deck, things like that. The new Unknown Nation is a solid card. There's plenty of evil battle extenders or just the opponent answering with their own Christian Martyr. So I'm not going to go and say that it gets me a soul 95% of the time, but it definitely gets it higher than 50. And the 50 that it doesn't get is because my opponent had to then burn a valuable resource of their own in order to stop my play, whether it was one of their add to battles, which are usually one-time effects, or if it was the dominant of their own, which is, I'm assuming, the fourth dominant that you're going to mention here, which is Christian Martyr.
Yeah, actually, for me, the next one, John, is Falling Away, and it's the Cloud. I play the Cloud version of Falling Away. And actually, for some of the similar reasons that you just mentioned about why Angel of the Lord isn't as high as 95%, like, you're right about that. Just listening to you talk about it, I'm like, duh, of course, it's not that high. Falling Away, for me, gets around some of those. For instance, there's lots of protection for discard, or you can add based off of whatever condition, where Falling Away as an evil dominant that converts a character, there's less protection against convert. It's easier to get off. And it has extreme offensive value in most meta decks right now. So for me, I actually lean towards Falling Away a little bit over Christian Martyr. But the next one for me at 5 is Christian Martyr.
Sure.
So that would round out my 5. I would go Son of God, Second Coming, Angel of the Lord, Falling Away, and Christian Martyr. And actually, I think in some cases you can argue that Falling Away could even go above Angel of the Lord because of its ability to be both offensive and defensive.
Yeah, and I agree with that. Falling Away is definitely probably the most versatile, flexible, dominant outside of Second Coming. I would pretty much agree with those five. The one thing I will say for newer to slightly experienced players, we're talking about the Second Coming, which is a $40, $50 card. I get it. Not everybody has $40 or $50 to drop on one card. And that's why I think the new Jerusalem promo is also a viable option if you don't have the resources to get to a Second Coming. I think probably in 8 out of 10 scenarios, Second Coming is going to be strictly better than the promo. I do think there are a couple of situations where the New Jerusalem promo is actually possibly better than Second Coming, predominantly in multiplayer. In multiplayer formats, I think there is a pretty good argument to be made for New Jerusalem over Second Coming. And again, if you don't have the resources to get a Second Coming, play New Jerusalem. Honestly, play the old one, the one that has to be played with Son of God and picks up a soul. That's fine too if you have to do that. Plenty of players have done that and been successful even after Second Coming came out. And obviously the promo is then an improvement over that in that I can copy the last good dominant played period, whether that was Son of God, Second Coming. I think if you can get your hands on one of those, probably for less than $10. I haven't looked to see what the price is on one of those. I would hope and assume anyway. You could honestly probably get one for $5 or, you know, just win a low level tournament and grab one that way.
For a while there, you know, we were seeing a lot of Hezekiah's Signet Ring. And actually, I think really the last 3 years, we've seen it a lot. And we probably still should have seen it more than we even did in the meta game. People don't like to run counters because it feels counterintuitive to a lot of people's play style. But Hezekiah's Signet Ring has so much value when you flip it over late game. Like somebody's already blown their destruction of the Houston. And then you flip it over late game before they've played their Second Coming, and they're sitting there feeling really bad, trying to conjure up a way to get rid of Hezekiah's Signet Ring. So that to me is another tip of the hat to the new or the old New Jerusalem, because you don't have to deal with that problem. So if somebody pulls that on you and you play a Destruction to Houston or the Chronicles of Kings, you know, if you play either of those dominants early, getting rid of an artifact that's really giving you trouble, you don't have to sweat as much if you don't have another answer for Hezekiah's Signet Ring. When you're sitting on New Jerusalem, for them, that Hezekiah Signet Ring then practically becomes a dead card late game. But you're sitting there feeling comfortable because you don't have to worry about it.
Absolutely. So Josiah gave you the first five staple dominance that he and I would play in every deck, pretty much no questions asked. There might be an odd scenario where we wouldn't play Falling Away because we couldn't quite fit it in because we wanted to play a couple other niche dominant stuff like that. There might honestly be a situation where Josiah says, I'm going to just go crazy all in offense. I'm not going to play Christian Martyr. I built a deck without Christian Martyr last year. It probably wasn't the right decision in the long run. But I think we would both agree those five are pretty much locked in all the time. So I'm going to give you six. And then we're going to talk about some of the niche dominance that can fill in that seven slot. So for me, I'm probably not playing a deck without three woes. It is too versatile and too good at answering my opponent's answers. And what I mean by that is what Josiah was just talking about, Hezekiah's Signet Ring, is a counter. It's the opponent's answer to your Second Coming. Three woes is then your answer to the opponent's Hezekiah's Signet Ring. So it's your answer to their answer, so to speak. And because of its refresh every turn where you can pick a different target for it, the value that it gives you over the course of a game is honestly pretty ridiculous. If you can drop it in the early to mid game, drop it during battle, pro players drop three woes during battle when possible. If there's something they absolutely have to answer, they'll drop it outside of battle. But good players wait for the opportunity to drop three woes in battle, use it as an in-battle negate, and then it sits on the table for the rest of the game, answering whatever answer you need to answer at any given time. If you drop it as good, you're looking at answering things like... My mind immediately went to Priest of Zeus. Priest of Zeus is CBI, so Woes isn't going to answer him. But things like Colosseum is something that it answers that's played as evil frequently. God of This World is a common counter card you'll see that it can answer. Any neutral card, obviously, either way you play it can answer neutral cards. And neutral cards are going to make up a large section of the answers, including what we're going to talk about, you know, later on, which is Lost Souls. There's a ton of powerful Lost Soul abilities that Three Woes, you know, honestly sits on a lot. Treacherous Land is another popular card that is a common three woes target that it sits on.
So for me, like you're talking about, you know, pro players hold three woes for that moment in battle. Being a perennial throne deck player, one of the best answers to throne is actually that black gold outsiders. And I can't tell you how many times I got hit with that on turn one. They would use that to then bury throne, bury, you know, all my purple kings that are in battle or whoever's in battle that they think I have enhancements for and leave me with just Samuel in battle. So many times that would happen. And because you've drawn so many resources, you end up with three woes in your hand and I'm playing three woes to hit the black and gold outsiders.
And exactly.
Then undo all of that. So I get all that stuff back. Yeah. And then they're sitting there feeling really bad because they have a character they don't really have enhancements for and don't have a lot of support for, but they know it's the best answer to my threats on turn one. So everybody's playing it, you know? So for me, like that's been one of the prime targets of three woes for me is hitting that black gold outsiders.
Absolutely. That's a clutch play, and that's exactly what we're talking about, is good players understand the answers to their answers. When you're playing a deck, you should be very familiar with it. Don't sit down, and I'm just as guilty as anybody else in this, don't sit down the night before a tournament and build your deck and play it. You will not be successful that way. Now, I'm not going to lie, I built decks the night before a tournament, and Josiah's laughing over there because Josiah builds all his decks the night before a tournament. He's just ridiculous like that. But I have built decks the night before a tournament and then gone on to win tournaments. Minnesota State in 2015. I literally built the deck the night before the tournament. It happens. It can work, but I'm not saying that you should do that. You should know your deck intimately before you sit down at the tournament table. You should have your deck built on Lackey. Lackey is a great place to get playtesting in. You can build the deck before you have the cards in your hand. You can know what the deck's going to do. You can make your adjustments. And then if you don't have all those cards, say, hey, I built this deck. I had a lot of success on Lackey with it. I'm going to go buy these four cards so I can build this deck in real life and go play a tournament with it. Lackey for about 2-3 years was actually really big. It was a great resource. It's a little smaller now. I don't see as many people on it utilizing it, which is unfortunate because it's a great place to learn and play. When I first really got deep success, I was playing on Lackey 3-4 games a day. And granted, I was younger and I had time, and now I'm married with kids and I work 55 some hours a week and I don't have time to do that. But when I first got good was because I was playing online all the time. And back then it wasn't Lackey, it was Redemption Table Simulator, which was an awesome app and just old. But we're dovetailing, we're getting off track here. All I'm saying is practice what you play. And by practicing your deck, doing goldfish draws at your own kitchen table, doing games against other players on Lackey, doing games for fun at Friday night playgroups with your playgroup, whatever it is, you know your deck inside and out. And by knowing that, you know what weaknesses it has. Everybody knows what the strengths of their deck are. Everyone's like, oh yeah, I'm going to push first turn auto, go to Samuel, draw a couple, drop a throne on the table, boom, 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 battle winner, son of God, second coming, game over. You know, we can all do that goldfish and say, yeah, this deck's awesome. This deck's great. I rock with this deck. But the difference I see between elite top flight players and the section just below that or two steps below that is elite top flight players know where their decks are weak. And they can then do one of two things. If they can, they fix that weakness. Now, that's sometimes not possible. Some decks just have weaknesses that cannot be fixed because of the way the deck is constructed. And I would tend to say that's probably not a very good deck, but I've definitely had decks that have had glaring weaknesses. I've simply known that the opponents aren't going to be able to exploit them very well or very frequently. So they can either fix that weakness or they can understand that weakness to a level where they know what the opponent needs to do in order to exploit that weakness so that they can prevent that from happening, having the counters to the counters. That goes back to what we talked about a couple weeks ago, the art of the bluff, where Josiah knows when he sits down across from me and I'm playing CWD, he knows he has to save an answer for Covenant with Death. And my weakness in that deck is if my opponent removes my Covenant with Death, I'm in trouble, because that was what the deck really ended up being built around, and how it functioned was stopping the opponent from making choices by having that so powerful card that affects everybody at the table. It affects you just as much as them, but I built around it, and theoretically they didn't. And so if they remove that, suddenly they get to do all their stuff that I'm trying to stop them from doing. And so that was the weakness of the deck. The weakness was its strength. It was such a strong, powerful card that it actually is the weakness of the deck, because not having that card that influenced the entire gravity of the deck build really changes how that deck plays. And so that's the weakness. And so I have to know when Josiah might have an answer for that. And Josiah has to know when I'm bluffing and baiting out his answer to my card.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying there, as far as like reading the situation, understanding the bluff, understanding when to push, when not to push. And that goes all the way back to what you were saying originally about the six dominant, three woes. It's a great way to have an answer to almost anything. You know, kind of ironically, it doesn't answer Covenant with Death, but it is a great, great answer to a ton of stuff, which actually brings me to a point that I was going to say. Actually, I believe with the Chronicle of Kings and Destruction of Nehushtan and Shipwreck and Rubble and Dust all being viable options to perform very similar functions as Three Woes, there's actually a little bit for me that says maybe I could start leaning towards playing some of those permanent removal cards over the Three Woes. I get that Three Woes can change targets, that it stays on the table, but it doesn't permanently remove anything. So if I'm sitting there and I know, wow, I cannot deal with both of these cards at the same time, Three Woes doesn't really help me in the long run, because I have to choose which, like, choose my poison. You know, I have to choose what I'm going to deal with, what I'm not going to deal with, and the fact that it doesn't answer Covenant with Death, which is one of the biggest counters to basically everything in the game right now, because it stops the— I actually think the bigger part of Covenant with Death is the fact that it stops the opponent from being able to play any of their territory class enhancements.
Absolutely.
Like that, it's that not is the negate. Devastating.
The negate is good, but the removal of the common speed element these days is what's bigger. The fact that you cannot— I'm essentially— what Covenant with Death really does at its core is ironically something that, as card designers, we've been pushing the game towards for a couple years now. We've been pushing the game towards interactions in battle phase. And Covenant with Death does that by essentially removing the prep phase from the game. It obviously doesn't actually remove it. Don't hear me say that. And there's things that you can do during the preparation phase still. But not being able to play territory class enhancements and not having your territory class character's effects take place, usually, with Covenant with Death on the table, really minimizes what you can do in the preparation phase. You can activate an artifact, you can play some characters on the table, you can play some fortresses and stuff like that. It doesn't affect that, but so many cards these days are territory class, and Covenant with Death stops all of those and pushes the game into that battle phase area, and that's what that card does more than anything else. The negate portion is really good for an opponent that's not prepared for it. But we have more cannot be prevented language on characters now than ever before. And there were plenty of times last year where players still got to use their abilities in battle against me.
Right, which points me back to why I would consider potentially at this stage of Redemption, removing Three Woes as the number six for me. Like, it feels really bad to say that in one sense, but permanent removal and being able to deal with Covenant with Death with your dominance that are not your soul winning or blocking dominance are that's a big difference for me. If I can deal with Covenant with Death with the dominant that I'm playing in my deck, or I can't.
Absolutely. And,
you know, that's in part because that card is so good. It's in part because John has continued to have success with it. And it's in part because I played Jerome forever. And from the time that card came out, he's been running it like crazy. Like, he used to run it in throne decks, which seems totally counterintuitive, but he did it in a way that like beat the pants off me for a long time. So I've hated that card for a decade.
Yeah, I honestly see that, Josiah. I can definitely see not playing Woes this year. I think probably last year, I think you probably still needed to, because I did come a little out of left field with the Covenant with Death deck. Not completely left field, because I posted it on the boards like 3 weeks to a month before Nationals. And so people knew that was what I was probably going to play. So it wasn't completely left field, but I don't think people necessarily expected that. And I don't think there were a lot of other people playing it either. Whereas this year, I think people are like, I mean, everybody loves a copycat. And yep. So we're seeing a lot more Covenant with Death this year, which makes three Woes not as supreme a counter as it used to be. So I can definitely see the argument for not playing Woes, which is why it's six. The first five, we pretty much agree on. There's some fringe scenarios where we might not play them, but Woes is really six. And Woes as number six means that you can make a pretty good argument for not playing it in favor of another Nish Dominant. So when we talk about Nish Dominance, we're talking about things like Destruction of Nehushtan, Chronicles of the Kings is a new one, things like A New Beginning is very specific to the Flood deck, Glory of the Lord is a Dominant that Josiah played for a couple years, and it's very specific to a very specific type of the Throne deck. You have things like Strife, another Dominant that Josiah has played to pretty good effect. That's a Nish Dominant. That's not one of your core Dominants that you play in every deck, but it can find its way into your deck if you have a specific purpose for it. For years, Burial was closer to a staple than a Nish, and now it doesn't see much play at all, but I think there are arguments to be made for it in that Nish setting. And specifically, the argument that I like is if you are playing a deck that is really hurt by your opponent having a certain Lost Soul, say the Covenant with Death deck, and your opponent has the Humble Lost Soul, that could be a problem for you. And so your solution is hope it's the only soul on the table and they have to give it to you when you rescue, or rescue it with your Son of God. And if you can't get to either one of those, then you're in trouble. But if you play Burial and you have enough soul generation, or if they drew a bunch of souls early, you could bury that soul. It's a unintuitive play and not a play that a lot of players would make, but I think there's an argument for it. So I think there is an argument for Burial as a Nish 7th Dominant. Or you're playing a 56 and you want to have some of that created soul control like we talked about in an earlier episode. The best defense in the game is not having souls on the table. Burial obviously assists that in that kind of deck where you are intentional about limiting the opportunities your opponent has to rescue.
And I want to touch on Burial for just a moment, because I actually think there's a chance this year that a dark horse strategy that could do extremely well is exactly what you just talked about. Running a 56 card deck that intends to soul drought. So you're not drawing a bunch. You know, you might search a little bit. You might do some of those like the new throne ability where you're looking at X cards and taking one, that type of thing. And the reason why is because of the number of cards that exchange a lost soul or two lost souls, etc. This set has the ability to flop lost souls between your territory and your opponent's. So if I'm running a 56 card deck that takes advantage of meek lost souls, so that's lost souls without an ability, just to clear up that lingo, meek. So I'm tossing those worthless lost souls over to my opponent. I'm taking the ability lost souls over to me. I'm sticking them in like Horma, and then I'm burying it under their deck. And then I'm doing that again and doing that again. And then I'm swapping with the Wanderer and I'm playing Death of Unrighteous to shuffle all the lost souls. I can effectively, like, I legitimately believe I can effectively get three and maybe even four lost souls a game from my Land of Bondage to my opponents while underdecking several of theirs back into their deck. I would absolutely play Burial in that deck in order to clear another lost soul off my table.
Absolutely.
I believe there's decks viable right now that could legitimately get to a point where your opponent only ever sees you put three lost souls on the table for them by the time you deck out for them to win the game. So they then have to be able to generate two and rescue them just to be able to get a lost soul, just to be able to get to five. So for me, like, I think Burial is a very viable Dominant right now. Now, obviously, it needs tested. It needs worked out. It would need perfected. But that idea is there, and there's enough assistance to it in this set, considering that Death of Unrighteous and Horma are still both viable cards to make that happen.
And the other thing I'll say is the other classic soul removal piece is Suicidal Swine Stampede, and pale green and orange have always played well together. Correct. So when Josiah says Death of Unrighteous, also hear Suicidal Swine Stampede or vice versa. You don't have to play both. I probably would if I was going to go after that kind of deck, just to give me more bites at the apple, so to speak. Yep. But, and see, I said that bites at the apple. That's a pun. See, players that are super in the know realize that if you're playing Death of Unrighteous and Suicidal Swine Stampede, you're playing the serpent. See, that's a little joke there. Josiah didn't get it. I'm disappointed in you.
I mean, I don't know if it was funny enough to be worth getting, so.
Wow. Harsh.
No, I'm actually sitting here thinking, John, I mean, there's enough multicolor characters in the game that, like, you're talking about Serpent. I think, honestly, you could justify getting just a Hireling in your reserve and then going to pull that out and play that in that same deck. So now you've got three ways to shuffle Souls plus Horma plus Burial. There's a good chance your opponent can't win the game. Like,
I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. The one thing that I'm going to disagree with you on, Jessa Hireling is a good card, but you have to discard a Pharisee or Sadducee. And while there are tons there's tons of multicolor characters, straight, true multicolor, things like Kings of the Earth and Pagan Sailors, where you get to pick what color they are when you need that color, and just true multicolor like Foreign Wives, I think you can play very easily both Swine Stampede and Death of Unrighteous. I don't know if Just a Hireling works. Maybe it does.
Got the caveat that says it has to hit a Pharisee or
something. Yeah. If it didn't have that caveat, absolutely, you'd be all over it. And you would definitely play that. So, yes, I think there's definitely a deck where Burial is viable. So, other dominants that we haven't mentioned yet that can fill in that seventh dominant slot as a niche dominant. We're getting four dominants this year. Three more that we haven't touched on yet. Doubt, Ride Awesome, and help me out, Josiah, what's the fourth one?
We've got Chronicles of Kings, Ride On Victoriously, which is, and also Awesome Things. That's the same dominant. Doubt, like you said, and Led Astray.
Yep. So I call it Ride Awesome. That's what Gabe called it all during playtesting. So that's just what I call it now, because the one side is awesome and the other is Ride On. So it's Ride Awesome, and that's what the dominant is. So that's a niche dominant. You're probably going to play that in a variety of Meek decks, but you're not going to play it in non-Meek decks, obviously. And there's probably a Meek music deck or a music Meek deck, something like that, where you play a couple Meek heroes in that classic music leader shell, so you can try to use both sides of it. I don't know how good that deck is.
There's a I actually think that there is a Meek music deck that you can play, and I actually what comes to mind to me is that red music enhancement, that it's like old, but it does something really good if I remember correctly. Is it Sing with Stringed Instruments? I think that's what it is, and I think it does some sort of a band. So, like, Music Leader can recur that for you, and then it gives you an ability to band in, like, a red guy or band in another character off of a red guy, which, you know, David is a musician who's also going to be red, so you're going to be able to band in a Himbelek using a recurable banding enhancement there. That's just a way to blend music in red. I know that's off topic of the niche or of the dominance we're talking about, but I do see a music deck making that very viable, especially considering you can trigger it twice. Like, I mean, not the same ability, but
we now pause this episode of Top Cut Savvy while John looks up a card so he can tell Josiah that he's just wrong. I legitimately, guys, have no idea what Josiah is talking about right now. So you said Sing with Stringed Instruments.
I'm pretty sure, dude.
I'm pretty sure that's white. So Sing with Stringed Instruments is a white enhancement, and it says if used by a musician, exchange this card with a white brigade card in your deck. Cannot be negated. So I don't think that's what you're thinking of.
Okay.
The only red,
a red one.
The only red music card that I can think of off the top of my head is Sing and Praise, and that's the side battle card. Sing and Praise is red's side battle card. It forces two evil characters to fight each other, and it negates special abilities on evil enhancements played in that side battle. There so that's the only one I can think of off
that,
the top of
that
my
head. That actually is the card I was thinking of, so I got stuff mixed up there. But
it's all good.
Still, nonetheless, like, that's a music card in red that fits in a music leader.
Yes, Absolutely.
Musician deck, like you should play that card if you're trying to play that deck.
You absolutely should. So here's some other red music cards, guys. If you want to build this deck, go out and build it. Send us a deck list. We would love to talk about deck lists that people send us. That's one thing we talked about in our preview opening episode, things that we would like to do. And we think that's a big help for the community. Post your deck list on the boards. Post it on Discord for all I care, and then send it, PM it to either Josiah or I. So I'm on Discord. I'm on the message boards. My username on both is Red Dragon Thorn Spaces. Send me a message on Discord, PM me on the boards. Josiah is JBeers285.
Got it. In both places.
In both places, he's JBeers285. Send your deck list to him. Send your deck list to me. We would love to, in a future episode, take a deck list and break it down and talk about choices that we would make different or things we think could be improved upon in that deck. Or if the deck is just that amazing, we'll be like, hey, this deck was submitted by Jesse Foresto and it is amazing. Or this deck was submitted by Jay Chambers and he's a boss. Play this deck. You know, obviously, we can probably find incremental improvements in just about anything. But so I'm gonna throw some other red cards at you that involve music that you could totally build a red-white music deck around. So we talked about Sing and Praise already. A couple of heroes for you. Barak came out in Cloud. He's a musician. Exchange Barak with Jail and comes with Deborah. So maybe you go kind of like green, red, white, something like that. You've got David the Shepherd. He's red and a musician. Obviously, David was a lot of things, including a musician. So you've got him. That might push you into that kind of musical throne thing. That's a deck that Josiah played around with a little bit last year. I tinkered with it a little bit, didn't spend a whole lot of time on it. That's a viable build of throne, is the musical throne option, where you play some music stuff around your throne pieces. Mighty Warrior, the Mighty Warrior, is another hero option for you. He's symbolic. He involves music. He might combo into an Isaiah type thing where you play like an Isaiah with some music stuff, or even honestly, he could fit into a throne deck as well. So those are some solid heroes for you. And then I've got one more enhancement, Burying Our Sin. It just came out last year in Prophecies of Christ. I don't know how good it is, but it's a heal and an add to battle. So it probably has some playability somewhere. The only thing with it is it has a unity on it. It has Unity Hero Share Brigade. So it's red, and most music decks are going to play Music Leader. So I'm not sure how good or playable that particular card really is in a musical deck. It's a pretty solid card if you're playing a mono brigade offense in one of its three brigades. It's three brigades. It's green, red, and teal. Those are all pretty popular brigades. The trick is they're usually paired with another brigade. So I do think that card probably has a deck that it gets played in, but just might not be this one that we're talking about. So there's some cards for you guys to play around with a little bit that came about just kind of as our discussion about this. And that's one of the great things about Top Cut Savvy, guys. And honestly, that's one of the reasons that Josiah and I wanted to start this podcast, was when Josiah and I get together, we have these kinds of conversations where we start off talking about, hey, what dominance do you think are really good right now? And we end up talking about red, white musical decks. And yes, we
rabbit. Which is awesome.
Which is awesome. And we enjoy those conversations, and we get a lot out of our conversations, and we wanted to share those conversations with you because we think you can get something out of them too. So back to niche dominance. We just talked about Ride Awesome, Ride On Victoriously, Awesome Things. That's going to be played in a music deck or in a meek deck. You can play it in a meek deck and expect to only get one use out of it, and that's fine. Or you can play it in a music deck and plan on getting both sides out of it. Then you've got Doubt. I think Doubt makes a pretty good argument for a lot of decks. It is pretty solid. It's way better than the old one. Like, way, way better than the old one. So I think it is, if you're not playing a niche dominant like A New Beginning or Glory that is very deck specific, I think Doubt makes a pretty good argument for dominant slot number 7 in a lot of decks, because it is pretty close to a block most times because of its add to battle ability. Add to battles are some of the strongest abilities in the game. The ability to extend the battle and make your opponent fight that war of attrition is really good. Gates of Hell has been probably one of the best defensive cards for a really long time. People were or should have been splashing demons into their decks for Gates of Hell pretty much since Gates of Hell came out, if we're being honest. It is pretty easy to splash King of Tyrus and two other demons, even if that demon is Messenger of Satan, to band right back into your main defense, which I did that for a couple of years. I played King of Tyrus, Messenger of Satan. I honestly don't think I played a third demon, and I played Gates of Hell just to have that add to battle, that battle extension. So the fact that Doubt has that built-in battle extension on it is really powerful. And then the ability on the character is kind of insane. So
in almost every defensive brigade, in fact, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, I can't think of a defensive brigade that doesn't have this, has a dual colored demon that is part of their, like I'm trying to think, like the Winged Lion is Babylonian and a demon, right?
Yeah,
so
it fits absolutely.
In Crimson, and so there's two versions of that you could play, like black and black demons. There's a ton of them. Like you could play a straight black demon for one, like Locust from the Pit, and try to discard a Sight or something if you really wanted to do that. But if you're getting that off an add to battle, that's not necessarily terrible, because you're adding a color that you're already playing. You're adding a demon that's not a color that they would expect coming in off of Gates of Hell. And if you happen to hit a good Sight, like that's awesome. Or like in gray orange, there's several there. Like, so there's lots of different demons that you can add in. So like to take that all the way back, you were talking about the value of Doubt, the fact that it's probably going to end up in a lot of decks this year and probably should. I actually think that there's some value in Doubt in not waiting for the add to battle, though. Like not waiting till they've eliminated all your characters and then pushing Doubt. I actually love the idea of pushing out some big band, especially since we got rid of Cascade Negate. Right. So since Cascade Negate isn't out there, they can't play one negate a banned card or a particular, they can't negate one evil character and push six evil characters back. So I actually really like the idea of, like, you know, I might have three evil characters banded in, and since they're not going to be Cascade Negated out back to one, now I'm going to push Doubt on top of that. I'm going to negate whatever hero abilities they triggered and force you to toss your multi-brigade enhancements, and I'm huge. So there's a chance I'm going to kill your heroes on top of getting the block. I think there's some, and that's one of those things where you're going to have to read the situation. Maybe you've used a hand spy and you looked at your opponent's hand and you realize, wow, all they have is multi-brigade enhancements. This is the perfect time to play Doubt. I'm going to kill their character because there's nothing they can do about it. You know, so it's a little bit of a niche kind of deciding when, but I actually see a lot of value in not waiting till it's the last possible moment and then pushing Doubt. Like I see value in pushing them earlier is what I'm getting at.
Led Astray, the fourth dominant in LEC.
Oh, dude.
Not so many options there.
Okay, but there's one amazing option, right? There's one amazing. Do you know where I'm going with this?
I know where you're going with it.
The second I saw this, I was like, oh, I'm going back to some foil cards, baby. Give me Hair to Grip of the Second, because we're putting him in battle and then playing Led Astray, baby. I saw that and I was like, this is Strife all over again. I know one great use for this, and it's the only great use there is, but I'm going to use it, you know? So, yeah, I mean, for those of you that don't know, Herod Agrippa II says something, blah, blah, blah. If a character withdraws, you may capture it instead. This is a cannot be negated ability. So if I'm playing the Unity Meek Lost Souls, then I can play Led Astray, which says withdraw all rescuing heroes. I want to put just a thing to note in there. It doesn't say withdraw all humans. It doesn't say withdraw all angels. It says withdraw all heroes, period. Like, so it doesn't matter what kind of hero, which makes this, you know, it has even a greater level of value there. And then if you've blocked with Herod Agrippa the Second before you play this dominant and then play it, you CBN capture all their heroes.
This has been Top Cut Savvy, produced and hosted by John Early and Josiah Beers, talking about Redemption CCG. Thank you all for listening.